Finally got to Tangier. Some incident at Archmaid's in which Marianne found her sari, the only item of clothing she had packed, unraveling and herself suddenly exposed, naked in the Casbah, caused panic to set in, especially in Brian, who ran back to the hotel, seized with fear. There they huddled in the corridors of the Minzer Hotel, on straw mats, grappling with hallucinations. Not a good beginning to Brian's recuperation. We went to Marrakesh, the whole troop, including Mick, who was waiting there for Marianne. Beaton was twitching about us, admiring our breakfast arrangements and my marvellous torso. Beaton was mesmerised by Mick. I was fascinated with the thin, concave lines of his body, legs, arms. When Brian, Anita and Marianne got to Marrakesh, Brian must have sensed something. Although Tom Keelock, who was the only person who knew about Anita and me, wouldn't have told him. And we're pretending barely to know each other. Yeah, we had a great trip, Brian. Everything was cool. Went to the Casbah. Valencia was lovely. The almost unbearable tension of the situation. And that was recorded by Michael Cooper in one of his most revealing photographs. And a chilling image in retrospect. The last picture of Anita and Brian and me together. It has a tension about it that still radiates. Anita staring straight at the camera. Me and Brian looking grimly away in different directions. A joint in Brian's hand. Cecil Beaton took one of Mick and me and Brian, who's clutching his Ewer tape recorder, bags under his eyes, malevolent and sad. It's not surprising that little or no work was done. I don't remember doing or composing anything with Mick in Morocco, which was rare at the time. We were too occupied. It was obvious that Brian and Anita had come to the end of their tether. They'd beaten the shit out of each other. There was no point in it. I never really knew what the beef was. If I were Brian, I would have been a little bit sweeter and kept the bitch, but she was a tough girl. She certainly made a man out of me. She had had almost nothing but turbulent, abusive relationships, and she and Brian had always been fighting. She ran away screaming, being chased in tears. She'd been used to this for so long. It was almost reassuring and normal. It's not easy to get out of those destructive relationships, to know how to end them. And of course, Brian starts his old shit again in Marrakesh in the Asadi Hotel, trying to take Anita on for 15 rounds. His reaction to whatever he sensed between Anita and me was more violent. And once again, he breaks two ribs and a finger or something, and I'm watching it, hearing it. Brian was about to sign his own exit card and help Anita and me on our way. There's no point to this non-interference anymore. We're stuck in Marrakesh. This is the woman I'm in love with. And I've got to relinquish her out of some formality. All of my plans of rebuilding my relationship with Brian are obviously going straight down the drain. In the condition he was in, there was no point in building anything with Brian. I'd done my best. Now it was just unacceptable. Then Brian dragged two tattooed whores, remembered by Anita, incidentally, as really hairy girls, down a hotel corridor and into the room, trying to force Anita into a scene, humiliating her in front of them. He started to fling food at her from the many trays he'd ordered up. At that point, Anita ran to my room. I thought Anita wanted out of there, and if I could come up with a plan, she would take it. Sir Galahad again. But I wanted her back. I wanted to get out. I said you didn't come to Marrakesh to worry that you've beaten up your old man so much he's lying in the bath with broken ribs. I can't take this shit anymore. I can't listen to you getting beaten up and fighting and all this crap. This is pointless. Let's get the hell out of here. Let's just leave him. We're having much more fun without him. It's been a very, very hard week for me, knowing that you're with him. Anita was in tears. She didn't want to leave, but she realized that I was right when I said that Brian would probably try and kill her. And so I planned the moonlight flit. When Cecil Beaton took that picture of me lying beside the pool at the hotel, I was actually figuring out an escape route. I was thinking, right, tell Tom to get the Bentley ready. It's just somewhere after sunset. We're getting out of here. The great moonlight flip from Marrakesh to Tangier was in motion. We set Brian Geisen up. We had Tom Keelock order him to take Brian into Marrakesh, into the Square of the Dead, with the musicians and acrobats, to do some recording with his Ewer tape recorder, to avoid what Tom had told him was an evasion of press hunting for Brian. And in the meantime, Anita and I drove to Tangier. We left late at night. Anita and I, with Tom at the wheel. Mick and Marianne had already left. In some written work, Geisen recorded the devastating moment when Brian got back to the hotel and called him. Come quickly. They've all gone and left me. Cleared out. I don't know where they've gone. No message. The hotel won't tell me. I'm here all alone. Help me. Come at once, Geisen writes. I go over there. I get him into a bed. I call a doctor to give him a shot and stick around long enough to see it take hold on him. Don't want him jumping down those 10 stories into the swimming pool. Anita and I got back to my little pad in St. John's Wood, which I'd hardly used since I moved into it with Linda Keith. It was quite a difference for Anita after Courtfield Gardens. We were hiding out from Brian there, and that took a while. Brian and I still had to work together, and Brian made desperate attempts to get Anita back. There was no chance of that happening. Once Anita makes up her mind, she makes up her mind. But there was still this intense period of hiding out and negotiating with Brian, and he just used that as an even bigger excuse to get even more and more out of there. It said that I stole her, but my take on it is that I rescued her. Actually, in a way, I rescued him, both of them. They were both on a very destructive course. Brian went to Paris and fell onto Anita's agent, howling that everyone had left him, fucked off and left him. He never forgave me. I don't blame him. He quickly got himself a chick, Suki Poitier, and we did somehow manage to tour together in March and April. Anita and I went to Rome that spring and summer, between the busts and the trials, where Anita played in Barbarella with Jane Fonda, directed by Jane's husband, Roger Vadim. Anita's Roman world centered around the Living Theatre, the famous anarchist pacifist troupe run by Judith Malina and Julian Beck. It's been around for years, but was coming into its own in this period of activism and street demos. The Living Theatre was particularly insane, hardcore. Its players often getting arrested on indecency charges. They had a play in which they recited lists of social taboos at the audience, for which they usually got a night in the slammer. Their main actor, a handsome black man named Rufus Collins. He was a friend of Robert Fraser, and they were a part of the Andy Warhol and Gerard Malanga connection. And so it all went round in a little avant-garde elite, as often as not drawn together by a taste for drugs, of which the LT was a centre. And drugs were not copious in those days. The living theatre was intense, but it had glamour. There were all those beautiful people attached, like Danielle Luna, who was the first famous black model in America, and Nico, and all those girls who were hovering around. Danielle Luna was with one of the guys from the theatre. Talk about a tiger, a leopard, one of the most sinuous chicks I've ever seen. Not that I tried or anything. She obviously had her own agenda, and all backlit by the beauty of Rome, which gave it an added intensity. One night, when she was doing Barbarella, Anita ended up in prison. She was with some guys from the Living Theatre when she was pulled over for drugs, and the police thought she was a transvestite. They put her into the tank, and as soon as they opened the door, everybody went, "Anita! Anita!" Everyone knew her. Talk about connections. And she's hissing, "Shut up!" Because her story was, she was the Black Queen, and she couldn't be arrested. A bit of a theatrical number that she thought would appeal to the enlightened Romans, or somehow divert them. She'd had to swallow a whole lump of hash when they caught her, so by then she was pretty high. They put her in a room with all the other queens, and eventually the next morning someone bailed her out. Those were days when police didn't really know how to handle the gender bender varieties. They didn't really know what was going on. Anita's friends were, as ever, a hip crowd of the period. People like the actor Christian Marcon, who directed Candy, the next film Anita worked on that summer, which starred, among a large cast of stars, Marlon Brando, who kidnapped her one night and read her poetry, and when that failed, tried to seduce Anita and me together. Later, pal. There were Paul and Talitha Getty, who had the best and finest opium. I fell in with some other reprobates, like the writer Terry Southern, with whom I got on well, and the picaresque, scarcely believable figure of the period, Prince Stanislas Klosowski Nerola, known as Stash, son of the painter Balthus. Stash was an Anita connection, from Paris, who had been sent by Brian Jones to try and get Anita back. Instead, he fell in with the poacher, me. Stash had the bullshit credentials of the period, the patter of mysticism, the lofty talk of alchemy and the secret arts, all basically employed in the service of Legover. How gullible were the ladies. He was a roué and a playboy, like to look upon himself as Casanova. What an amazing creature to sweep through the 20th century. He played with Vince Taylor, an American rock and roller, who came over to England and never quite made it, but had a big success in France. Stash was in his band, playing tambourine, with one black glove. He loved his music. He loved to dance in this weird, aristocratic way. I was always convinced Stash was going to break out into a minuet. He wanted to be one of the lads, but he could also do "I'm Prince Blah Blah, All Hot Air." We lived together in this magnificent palace, the Villa Medici, with its former gardens, one of the most elegant buildings in the world, as Stash had managed to pull off. His father, Balthus, had an apartment there, some diplomatic role via the French Academy, which owned the building. Balthus was away, so we had his place to ourselves. Down the Spanish steps for lunch, nightclubs, hanging out at the Villa Medici, going to the gardens of the Villa Borghese. It was my version of the grand tour. There was also this undercurrent of revolution in the air. A lot of political undertones, all half-assed except for the Red Brigades later. Before the riots in Paris the following year, the students started a revolution at the University of Rome, which I went to. They barricaded it. They sneaked me in. Ah, they were all flash-in-the-pan revolutionaries. Me, I had nothing to do, really. Sometimes I go to the studio and see Fonda and Vadim at work. Anita went to work, and I didn't. Like some sort of Roman pimp or something. Send the woman to work and hang about. It was weird. I was enjoying it, but at the same time, there was that sort of itch. Shouldn't I be doing something? Meanwhile, Tom Keelock is there with my Bentley. Blue Lena had loudspeakers in the grill, and Anita used to terrorize the Romans by putting on a woman policeman's voice, reading out their number plate and ordering them to turn immediately to the right. The car flew a Vatican flag with the keys of St. Peter. Marianne and Mick stay with us for a while. Hear Marianne on the subject. Now that's a trip I'll never forget. Me and Mick and Keith and Anita and Stash. On acid, at night, in the full moon at the Villa Medici. It was just utterly beautiful. And Anita's smile, I remember. I mean, her wonderful smile in those days, which promised everything. When she was having a good time, she was so full of promise. She gave this incredible smile, which was quite frightening, too. All those teeth, like a wolf, like a cat that got the cream. If you were a man, it must have been very powerful. She was gorgeous because she was so beautifully dressed, always in the perfect costume. Anita had a huge influence on the style of the times. She could put anything together and look good. I was beginning to wear her clothes most of the time. I would wake up and put on what was lying around. Sometimes it was mine, and sometimes it was the old lady's. But we were the same size, so it didn't matter. If I'd sleep with someone, I at least have the right to wear her clothes. But it really pissed off Charlie Watts, with his walking cupboards of impeccable Savile Row suits, that I started to become a fashion icon for wearing my old lady's clothes. Otherwise, it was plunder, loot, that I wore. Whatever was thrown at me on stage or what I picked up off stage and happened to fit, I would say to somebody, I like that shirt, and for some reason, they felt obliged to give it to me. I used to dress myself by taking clothes off other people. I was never really interested very much in my look, so to speak. Although I might be a liar there. I used to spend hours stitching old pants together to give them a different look. I'd get four pairs of sailor pants. I'd cut them off at the knee, get a band of leather, and then put another colour from the other pair of pants and stitch them in. Lavender and dull rose, as Cecil Beaton says. I didn't realise he was keeping an eye on that shit. I did enjoy hanging out with Stash and his degenerates. Well, look who's talking. They cover my fucking ass, right? I had no particular desire to get into that area of society, a European bullshit high society. I'd use them when I could. I don't want to knock the man. I always like to hang with him. And yes, I could say he's so shallow you couldn't paddle in it. And Stash would know exactly what I mean. And he knows he deserves it, little snipe. He got enough out of me, and I let him get away with a few things. I know exactly how tough he is. One kick up the bum, and he's gone. I used to believe in law and order and British Empire. I thought Scotland Yard was incorruptible. Wonderful. I fell for the whole shtick. The coppers I came up against told me what it was really about. Amazing to think now that I was shocked, but I was. The bust we were subjected to was set against the background of massive corruption in Metropolitan Police at the time, and for the next few years, which culminated in the commissioner publicly firing a great many CID officers and prosecuting others. It was only by getting busted that we realised how fragile the structure really was. They're shitting themselves with fear now because they've busted us and they don't know what to do with us. It was sort of eye-opening. What have they got at Redlands? Some Italian speed that Mick had on script anyway. And they found some smack on Robert Fraser and that was it. And because they found a few roaches in the ashtray, I got done for allowing people to smoke marijuana on my premises. It was so tenuous. They got nothing out of it. In fact, what they got was a big black eye. On the day, almost on the hour, that Mick and I were charged, on May 10th, 1967, Brian Jones was simultaneously busted in his apartment in London. The stitch-up was orchestrated and synchronized with rare precision. But due to some small glitch of stage management, the press actually arrived, television crews included, a few minutes before the police knocked on Brian's door with their warrant. The police had to push through the army of hacks they'd summoned to get to the door. But his collusion was barely noticeable when the farce that unfolded. The Redlands trial in late June was in Chichester, which was still in 1930 when it came to the judicials. On the bench was Judge Block, who was probably 60-odd, about my age now at the time. This was my first ever show in court. You don't know how you're going to react. In fact, I had no choice. He was so offensive, obviously trying to provoke me so that he could do what he wanted. He called me for having used my premises for the smoking of cannabis resin, scum and filth, and said, "People like this shouldn't be allowed to walk free." So when the prosecutor said to me that surely I must have known what was going on, what with a naked girl wrapped in a rug, which is basically what I was being done for, I did not just say, "Oh, sorry, Your Honour." The actual exchange went as follows. "There was, as we know, a young woman sitting on a settee wearing only a rug. Would you agree in the ordinary course of events you would expect a young woman to be embarrassed if she had nothing on but a rug in the presence of 8 men, 2 of whom were hangers-on and the 3rd a Moroccan servant? Not at all. You regard that, do you, as quite normal? We're not old men. We're not worried about petty morals." It got me a year in Wormwood Scrubs. I only did a day, as it turned out, but that was what the judge thought of my speech. He gave me the heaviest sentence he thought he could get away with. I found out later that Judge Block was married to the heiress of Shipham's fish paste. If I'd known about his fish wife, I could have come out with a better one. We'll leave it at that. That day, June 29th, 1967, I was found guilty and sentenced to 12 months in prison. Robert Fraser was given 6 months and Mick 3 months. Mick was in Brixton. Fraser and I went to the Scrubs that night. What a ludicrous sentence. I mean, how much do they hate you? I wonder who was whispering in the judge's ear. If he had listened to Wise information, he would have said, "I'll just treat this as 25 quid and out of here. This case is nothing." In retrospect, the judge actually played into our hands. He managed to turn it into a great PR coup for us. Even though I must say I didn't enjoy Wormwood Scrubs, even for 24 hours. The judge managed to turn me into some folk hero overnight. I've been playing up to it ever since. But the dark side of this was discovering that we'd become the focal point of a nervous establishment. There's two ways the authorities can deal with a perceived challenge. One is to absorb and the other is to nail. They had to leave the Beatles alone because they'd already given them medals. We got the nail. It was more serious than I thought. I was in jail because I'd obviously pissed off the authorities. I'm a guitar player in a pop band, and I'm being targeted by the British government and its vicious police force, all of which shows me how frightened they are. We won two world wars, right? And these people are shivering in their goddamn boots. All of your children will be like this if you don't stop this right now. There was such ignorance on both sides. We didn't know we were doing anything that was going to bring the Empire crashing to the floor. And they were searching in the sugar bowls, not knowing what they were looking for. But it didn't stop them trying again and again and again and again for the next 18 months. It coincided with their learning about drugs. They'd never heard of them before. I used to walk down Oxford Street with a slab of hash as big as a skateboard. I wouldn't even wrap it up. This was 65, 66. It was that brief moment of total freedom. We didn't even think that it was illegal what we were doing. And they knew nothing about drugs at all. But once that came on the menu in about 67, they saw their opportunity as a source of income or a source of promotion or another avenue to make more arrests. It's easy to bust a hippie, and it got very easy to plant a couple of joints on people. It was just so common they expected it. Most of the first day of the prison sentence was induction. You get in with the rest of the inductees and take a shower, and they spray you with lye spray. Oh, nice one, son. The whole place is meant to intimidate you to the max. The scrubs wall is daunting to look at, 20 feet, but someone tapped me on the shoulder and said, Blake got over it. 9 months earlier, the spy George Blake's friends had dropped a ladder over the wall and spirited him away to Moscow. A sensational escape. But having Russian friends to spirit you away is another thing. I walked around in an orderly circle with so much rabbit going on, it took me a while to get a touch on the back. Keith, you got bail, you sod. I said, any messages? Give them to me now. I had to deliver about 10 notes to families. Tearful. There were some mean mothers there, most of them were warders. The head bugger said to me as I got in the Bentley, you'll be back. I said to him, not on your time, I won't. Our lawyers had filed an appeal, and I'd been released on bail. Before the appeal hearing, the Times, great champion of the underdog, came unexpectedly to our assistance. There must remain a suspicion, wrote William Rees-Mogg, the Times editor in his piece, Who Breaks a Butterfly on a Wheel, that Mr. Jagger received a harsher sentence than would ever have been handed down to an unknown defendant, i.e., you've cocked it up and made British justice look bad. In actual fact, we got saved by Rees-Mogg, because believe me, I felt like a butterfly at the time, and I'm going to be broke. When you look back at the brutality of the establishment and the Profumo affair, something as dirty as any John le Carré story, in which inconvenient players were framed and hounded to their death, I'm quite amazed it didn't get more bloody than it did. In that same month, my conviction was overturned and Mix was upheld, but his sentence squashed. Not so lucky, Robert Fraser, who had pleaded guilty to heroin possession. He had to do his porridge. I think that the experience and the King's African Rifles had more effect on him then Wormwood Scrubs. He'd thrown loads of guys in the jankers, army for the glasshouse, which is slopping out the bugs or digging new latrines. It wasn't as if he had no idea about confinement and punishment. I'm sure Africa was a bit rougher than anywhere else. He went in very bold, never flinched. I thought he came out very bold too. Bow tie, cigarette holder. I said, let's get stoned. The same day we were released, the strangest TV discussion ever filmed took place between Mick, flown in by helicopter to some English lawn, and representatives of the ruling establishment. They were like figures from Alice, chessmen. A bishop, a Jesuit, an attorney general, and Rees Mogg. They'd been sent out as a scouting party, waving a white flag to discover whether the new youth culture was a threat to the established order, trying to bridge the unbridgeable gap between the generations. They were earnest and awkward, and it was ludicrous. Their questions amounted to, what do you want? We're laughing up our sleeves. They were trying to make peace with us, like Chamberlain. Little bit of paper. Peace in our time. Peace in our time. All they're trying to do is retain their positions. But such beautiful English earnestness, this concern, it was astounding. Yet you know they're carrying weight. They can bring down some heavy-duty shit. So there were this underlying aggressiveness in the guise of all this amused curiosity. In a way, they were begging Mick for answers. I thought Mick came off pretty well. He didn't attempt to answer them. He just said, "You're living in the past." Much of that year, we struggled haphazardly to make their Satanic Majesty's request. None of us wanted to make it, but it was time for another Stones album, and Sgt. Pepper's was coming out, so we thought basically we were doing a put-on. We do have the first 3D record cover of all time. That was acid too. We made that set ourselves. We went to New York, put ourselves in the hands of this Japanese bloke with the only camera in the world that could do the 3D. Bits of paint and saws, bits of styrofoam. We need some plants. Okay, we'll go down the flower district. It coincided with the departure of Andrew Oldham, dropping the pilot, who was now in a bad way, getting shock treatment for some insurmountable mental pain to do with women trouble. He was also spending a lot of time with his own label, Immediate Records. Things might have run their course, but there was something between Mick and him that couldn't be resolved, that I can only speculate on. They were falling out of sync with each other. Mick was starting to feel his oats and wanted to test it out by getting rid of Oldham. And to be fair to Mick, Andrew was getting big ideas. And why not? A year or two before, he was nobody. Now he wanted to be Phil Spector. But all he's got is his five-piece rock and roll band to do it with. He would spend an inordinate amount of time, once a couple of hits had rolled in, trying to make these Spector-type records. Andrew wasn't concentrating on the Stones anymore. Added to that, we could no longer create coverage in the way Oldham had done. We were no longer writing the headlines, we were ducking them. And that meant another of Oldham's jobs had gone. His box of tricks was exhausted. Anita and I went back to Morocco for Christmas in 1967, with Robert Fraser, soon after he got out of jail. Chrissy Gibbs took a house belonging to an Italian hairdresser in Marrakesh. It was a house with a big garden that had run wild. The garden was full of peacocks and white flowers coming up through weeds and grass. Marrakesh gets very dry, And when the rains come, all this vegetation comes piercing through. It was cold and wet, so there was a lot of making fires in the house. And we were also smoking a lot of dope. Gibbs had a big pot of marjan, the Moroccan candy made of grass and spices that he brought from Tangier. And Robert was very keen about this person who Brian Geisen had put us all onto, who was also a maker of marjan. Mr. Very Good, who worked in the mishmash, the jam, factory, and made us apricot jam in the evening. We had dropped in on Ahmed in Tangier on the way. His shop was now decorated with collages of the stones. He'd cut up old seed catalogues, and our faces peered out from a forest of sweet peas and hyacinths. This was the period when dope could be mailed in various ways, and the best hash, if you could get any, was Afghani Primo, which used to come in two shapes, like flying saucers with a seal on it, or in the shape of a sandal, or the sole of a sandal. And it used to have white veins in it that were apparently goat shit, part of the cement. And over the next couple of years, Ahmed would send out large quantities of hashish sealed in the bases of brass candlesticks. Soon he had four shops in a row, and big American cars with Norwegian au pair girls falling out the back. All kinds of wonderful things happened to him. And then, a couple of years later, I heard he was in a slammer with everything taken from him. Gibbs looked after him and kept in touch with him until he died. Tangier was a place of fugitives and suspects, marginal characters acting other lives. On the beach in Tangier on that trip, we saw these two strange beach boys walking along, dressed in suits, looking like the Blues Brothers. It was the Cray twins. Ronnie liked little Moroccan boys, and Reggie used to indulge him. They brought a touch of South End with them, handkerchief knotted on the corners over the head and trousers rolled up. And those were the days when you were reading about how they'd murdered the axemen and all those people nailed to the floor. The rough mixed with the smooth. Paul Getty and his beautiful and doomed wife, Talitha, had just bought their huge palace at Sidi Maman, where we stayed one night. There was a character called Arndt Krupp von Bullen und Holbach, whose name I remember because he was the gaily painted heir to the Krupp millions, and a degenerate even by my standards. I believe he may have been in the car during one of the most terrifying moments I've had in a motor car, in one of my closest shades with mortality. Certainly Michael Cooper was in the car, and maybe Robert Fraser, and one other. It might have been Krupp. And had it been the heir to the munitions empire, it would have been ironic what nearly befell us. Well, we'd gone on a trip to Vez and rented Peugeot and left at night to go back to Marrakesh, across the Atlas Mountains. I was driving. Up there, among the hairpin bends, halfway down, round the corner right in front of me, without any buy or leave, coming at us, there were these two motorcycles. Military, I realized by the uniforms, and they were covering all of the road. So he managed to swerve there, I managed to get round here, but down below is half a mile of forget about it. So I pull back in, swerve around, and in front of me now is this huge truck with more motorcycle outriders. And I ain't going over, so I clipped one of the motorcyclists and I went right by the thing. They went bananas. And as we were passing by it, there's a huge missile, a rocket, on the truck. We're going round the bend, and we've just made it. I've got one wheel over the abyss. I just managed to save us. What the fuck is this doing in the middle of the road? And seconds later, boom! It went over. We hear this huge crash and explosion. It was so fast, I don't think they knew what happened. This was a long, big motherfucker, an articulated truck. But how we got away with it, I don't really know. Just drove on, foot down, deal with the hairpins. My night driving abilities were famous at that time. We changed cars when we got down in Meknes. I went to the garage and said, "This car isn't working very well. Can we rent another one?" We just got the hell out of there. I was expecting NATO on my tail or something. At least an immediate military response, helicopters and searchlights. The next day, we're looking in the papers. Not a mention. Falling down a cliff into an abyss, destroying a third world rocket, would have been a sad end. Perhaps the only fitting send-off for the heir to the Krupp armaments fortune. I was suffering from hepatitis on that trip, and virtually crawled out of there. But my luck still holding into the welcoming arms of one of medicine's great Dr. Feelgoods, Dr. Ben Sasson in Paris. Anita took me to Catherine Harley. She was a model agent, a Sufi, an incredible woman who had a great range of contacts. She was like Anita's spiritual mother and took her in when she was ill or in trouble. It was she who Brian Jones went to when Anita left, to try and get her back. It was Catherine who put me in touch with Dr. Ben Sasson. Already the name, Algerian probably, gave me the hope of something other than conventional medicine. Dr. Ben Sasson used to go to Orly Airport and meet sheiks and kings and princes who were just stopping off on their way to somewhere else. And he would go and fix them up, whatever the time of day or night. In my case, it was heavy-duty hepatitis, and it was really sucking me out. I had no strength. I went to visit Dr. Ben Sasson, who gave me this shot. It took 20 minutes to go in, and it was basically a concoction of vitamins, everything that's good for you, and then something else very nice. I'd crawl into his store and just manage to get my ass in there, and half an hour later I'd walk back. Forget the car. An amazing shot, amazing cocktail concoction. Whatever it was, I've got to take my hat off. I mean, in 6 weeks he had me rocking. And not only did he deal with the hepatitis, he built me up and made me feel good at the same time. But I also have an incredible immune system. I cured myself of hepatitis C without even bothering to do anything about it. I'm a rare case. I read my body very well. The only trouble was that with these preoccupations and interruptions, the legal problems, the flights abroad, the wobbling of our relationship with Oldham, we had been temporarily distracted from what was now alarming in evidence. The Rolling Stones had run out of gas. Chapter 7, in which in the late 1960s I discover open tuning and heroin, meet Gram Parsons, sail to South America, become a father, record Wild Horses and Brown Sugar in Muscle Shells, survive Altamont, and re-meet a saxophonist named Bobby Keys. We'd run out of gas. I don't think I realized it at the time, but that was a period where we could have founded a natural end to a hit-making band. It came soon after Satanic Majesties, which is all a bit of flim-flam to me. And this is where Jimmy Miller comes into the picture as our new producer. What a great collaboration. Out of the drift, we extracted Beggar's Banquet and helped take the Stones to a different level. This is where we had to pull out the good stuff, and we did. I remember our first meeting with Jimmy. Mick was instrumental in getting him involved. Jimmy came from Brooklyn originally, grew up in the West. His father was entertainment director of the Vegas gambling hotels, the Sahara, the Dunes, the Flamingo. We turned up in Olympic Studios and said, we'll have a run through and see how things go. We just played. Anything. We weren't trying to make a track that day. We were feeling the room, feeling Jimmy out, and Jimmy was feeling us out. I'd like to go back and be a fly on that wall. All I remember is having a very, very good feeling about him when we left the session about 12 hours later. I was playing the stuff, going into the control room, usual old trick, and actually hearing on the playback what was going on in the room. Sometimes what you're playing in the room is totally different from what you hear in the control room. But Jimmy was hearing the room, hearing the band. So I had a very strong thing with him from that first day. He had a natural feel for the band because of what he'd been doing, working with English guys. He'd produce things like I'm a Man and Give Me Some Lovin' by the Spencer Davis Group. He'd worked with Traffic, Blind Faith. He worked a lot with black guys. But most of all, it was because Jimmy Miller was a damn good drummer. He understood groove. He's the drummer on Happy. He was the original drummer on You Can't Always Get What You Want. He made it very easy for me to work. Mainly for me to set the groove, set the tempos. And at the same time, Mick and Jimmy were communicating well. It gave Mick confidence to go along with him too. Our thing was playing Chicago blues. That's where we took everything that we knew. That was our kickoff point, Chicago. Look at that Mississippi River. Where does it come from? Where does it go? Follow that river all the way up, and you'll end up in Chicago. Also, follow the way those artists were recorded. There were no rules. If you looked at the regular way of recording things, everything was recorded totally wrong. But what is wrong and what is right? What matters is what hits the ear. Chicago blues was so raw and raucous and energetic. If you try to record it clean, forget about it. Nearly every Chicago blues record you hear is an enormous amount over the top, loading the sound on in layers of thickness. When you hear Little Walter's records, he hits the first note on his harp, and the band disappears until that note stops, because he's overloading it. When you're making records, you're looking to distort things, basically. I mean, that's the freedom recording gives you, to fuck around with a sound. And it's not a matter of sheer force. It's always a matter of experiment and playing around. Hey, this is a nice mic, but if we put it a little closer to the amp, and then take a smaller amp instead of the big one, and shove that mic right in front of it, cover the mic with a towel, let's see what we get. What you're looking for is where the sounds just melt into one another. And you've got that beat behind it. And the rest of it just has to squirm and roll its way through. If you have it all separated, it's insipid. What you're looking for is power and force without volume, an inner power. A way to bring together what everybody in that room is doing and make one sound. So it's not two guitars, piano, bass, and drums. It's one thing. It's not five. You are there to create one thing. Jimmy produced Beggar's Banquet. Let It Bleed, Sticky Fingers, every Stones record through Goat's Head Soup in 1973, the backbone stuff. But the best thing we ever did with Jimmy Miller was Jumping Jack Flash. That song and Street Fighting Man came out of the very first sessions with Jimmy at Olympic Studios for what would become Beggar's Banquet in the spring of 1968, the May of Street Fighting in Paris. Suddenly, between us, this whole new idea started to blossom, this new second wind, and it just became more and more fun. Mick was coming up with some great ideas and great songs, like Dear Doctor. I think probably Marianne had something to do with that, and Sympathy for the Devil. Although, it was not in the way he envisioned it when it started. I mean, but that's in the Godard movie. I'll deal with Godard later, where you hear and see the transformation of the song. Parachute Woman, with that weird sound area, like a fly buzzing in your ear or a mosquito or something, that song came so easily. I thought it was going to be difficult because I had that concept of that sound and wasn't sure it would work, but Mick jumped on the idea just like that, and it took little time to record. Salt of the Earth. I think I came up with the title of that and had the basic spur of it, but Mick did all the verses. This was our thing. I'd spark the idea. Let's drink to the hard-working people. Let's drink to the salt of the earth. And after that, Mick, it's all yours. Halfway through, he'd say, where do we break it? Where do we go to the middle? Where's the bridge? See how long he would take this one idea before he turned to me and said, we got to go somewhere else now. Ah, the bridge. Some of that is technical work, a matter of discussion, and usually very quick and easy. There was a lot of country and blues on Beggar's Banquet. No Expectations, Dear Doctor, even Jigsaw Puzzle. Parachute Woman, Prodigal Son, Stray Cat Blues, Factory Girl. They're all either blues or folk music. By then we were thinking, hey, give us a good song. We can do it. We've got the sound, and we know we can find it one way or another if we've got the song. And we'll chase the damn thing all around the room up to the ceiling. We know we've got it, and we'll lock onto it and find it. I don't know what it was in this period that worked so well. Maybe timing. We had barely explored the stuff where we come from or that it turned us on. The Dear Doctors and Country Hunks in Love and Vain, well, they were in a way catch-up, things we had to do. The mixture of black and white American music had plenty of space in it to be explored. We also knew that the Stones fans were digging it, and there were an awful lot of them by then. Without thinking about it, we knew that they'd love it. All we've got to do is what we want to do, and they're going to love it. That's what we're about. Because if we love it, a certain thing comes across from it. They were damn good songs. We never forget a good hook. We've never let one go when we found it. I think I can talk for the Stones most of the time. And we didn't care what they wanted out there. That was one of the charms of the Stones. And the rock and roll stuff that we did come out with on Beggar's Banquet was enough. You can't say, apart from Sympathy or Street Fighting Man, that is rock and roll on Beggar's Banquet at all. Stray Cat is a bit of funk, but the rest of them are folk songs. We were incapable of writing to order to say we need a rock and roll track. Mick tried it later with some drivel. It was not the interesting thing about the Stones, just sheer rock and roll. I love rock and roll on stage, but it was not something we particularly recorded a lot of, unless we knew we had a diamond, like Brown Sugar or Stone Me Up. And also, it kind of made the up-tempo numbers stand out even more, against the lovely bedrock of really great little songs, like No Expectations. I mean, the body of work was not as smashy between the eyes. This was not heavy metal. This was music. Flash. Shit, what a record. All my stuff came together and all done on a cassette player. With Jumpin' Jack Flash and Street Fightin' Man, I discovered a new sound I could get out of an acoustic guitar. That grinding, dirty sound came out of these crummy little motels where the only thing you had to record with was this new invention called the cassette recorder. And it didn't disturb anybody. Suddenly, you had a very mini studio. Playing an acoustic, you'd overload the Philips cassette player to the point of distortion so that when it played back, it was effectively an electric guitar. You're using the cassette player as a pickup and an amplifier at the same time. You were forcing acoustic guitars through a cassette player, and what came out the other end was electric as hell. An electric guitar will jump live in your hands. It's like holding on to an electric eel. An acoustic guitar is very dry, and you have to play it a different way. But if you can get that different sound electrified, you get this amazing tone and this amazing sound. I've always loved the acoustic guitar, loved playing it. And I thought, if I can just power this up a bit without going to electric, I'll have a unique sound. It's got a little tingle on the top. It's unexplainable, but it's something that fascinated me at the time. In the studio, I plugged the cassette into a little extension speaker and put a microphone in front of the extension speaker so it had a bit more breath and depth, and put that on tape. That was the basic track. There are no electric instruments on Street Fighting Man at all, apart from the bass, which I overdubbed later. All acoustic guitars. Jumping Jack Flash, the same. I wish I could still do that, but they don't build machines like that anymore. They put a limiter on it soon after that, so you couldn't overload it. Just as you're getting off on something, they put a lock on it. The band all thought I was mad, and they sort of indulged me. But I heard a sound that I could get out of there, and Jimmy was onto it immediately. Street Fighting Man, Jumpin' Jack Flash, and Half a Gimme Shelter were all made just like that, on a cassette machine. I used to layer guitar on guitar. Sometimes there are 8 guitars on those tracks. You just mash them up. Charlie Watts's drums on Street Fighting Man are from this little 1930s practice drummer's kit, in a little suitcase that you popped up, one tiny cymbal, a half-sized tambourine that served as a snare. And that's really what it was made on. Made on rubbish. Made in hotel rooms. With our little toys. That was a magic discovery. But so were these riffs. These crucial, wonderful riffs that just came. I don't know where from. I'm blessed with them. And I can never get to the bottom of them. When you get a riff like Flash, you get a great feeling of elation, a wicked glee. Of course, then comes the other thing. of persuading people that it is as great as you actually know it is. You have to go through the poo-poo, you know. Flash is basically satisfaction in reverse. Nearly all of these riffs are closely related. But if someone said you can play only one of your riffs ever again, I'd say, okay, give me Flash. I love satisfaction dearly and everything, but those chords are pretty much a de rigueur course as far as songwriting goes. But Flash is particularly interesting. It's all right now. It's almost Arabic, well, very old, archaic, classical. The chord setups you could only hear in Gregorian chants or something like that. And it's that weird mixture of your actual rock and roll and at the same time this weird echo of very, very ancient music that you don't even know. It's much older than I am, and that's unbelievable. It's like a recall of something, and I don't know where it came from. But I know where the lyrics came from. They came from a grey dawn at Redlands. Mick and I had been up all night. It was raining outside, and there was the sound of these heavy, stomping rubber boots near the window, belonging to my gardener, Jack Dyer, real countryman from Sussex. It woke Mick up. He said, "What's that?" I said, "Oh, that's Jack. That's Jumpin' Jack." I started to work around the phrase on the guitar, which was an open tuning, singing the phrase, "Jumpin' Jack." Mick said, "Flash." And suddenly, we had this phrase with a great rhythm and ring to it. So we got to work on it and wrote it. I can hear the whole band take off behind me every time I play Flash. There's this extra sort of turbo overdrive. You jump on the riff and it plays you. We have ignition? Okay, let's go. Daryl Jones will be right next to me on the bass. What are we on now, Flash? Okay, let's go. 1, 2, 3. And then you don't look at each other again, because you know you're in for the ride now. It'll always make you play it different, depending what tempo you're in. Levitation is probably the closest analogy to what I feel. Whether it's Jumpin' Jack or Satisfaction, we're all down the line. When I realize that I've hit the right tempo and the band's behind me, it's like taking off in a Learjet. I have no sense that my feet are touching the ground. I'm elevated to this other space. People say, "Why don't you give it up?" I can't retire until I croak. I don't think they quite understand what I get out of this. I'm not doing it just for the money or for you. I'm doing it for me. The big discovery, late 1968 or early 1969, was when I started playing the open 5-string tuning. It transformed my life. It's the way of playing that I use for the riffs and songs the Stones are best known for. Honky Tonk Women, Brown Sugar, Tumbling Dice, Happy, all down the line. Start Me Up and Satisfaction, Flash too. I had hit a kind of buffer. I just really thought I was not getting anywhere from straight concert tuning. I wasn't learning anymore. I wasn't getting some of the sounds I really wanted. I'd been experimenting with tunings for quite a while. Most times I went into different tunings because I had a song going and I was hearing it in my head, but I couldn't get it out of the conventional tuning no matter any way I looked at it. Also, I wanted to try to go back and use what a lot of the old blues guitarists were playing and transpose it to electric, but keep the same basic simplicity and straightforwardness, that pumping drive that you hear with the acoustic blues players. Simple, haunting, powerful sounds. And then I found out all this stuff about banjos. A lot of five-string playing came from when Sears Roebuck offered the Gibson guitar in the very early 20s, really cheap. Before that, banjos were the biggest selling instrument. Gibson put out this cheap, really good guitar, and cats would tune it, since they were nearly all banjo players, to a five-string banjo tuning. Also, you didn't have to pay for the other string, the big string. Or you could save it for hanging the old lady or something. Most of rural America bought this stuff from the Sears catalogue. Rural America was where it was really important. In the cities, you could shop around. In the Bible Belt, rural America...